By the time they neared the Stack Islands again, daylight had faded into murky night. They'd had clouds all the way, which was supposed to be protective, though Margu found it dreary as the plane seemed to crawl between two layers of darkening gray. As the light failed, no lights came on in the plane. For security reasons, she was told, but she could feel all around her the bulky shapes of the Nems. The professor had fallen asleep, and Margu leaned cautiously against his shoulder, letting herself doze. She couldn't lean the other way. The unfamiliar sidearm poked her. She woke when the plane slanted downward and peered out the window into darkness.
You see anything?
No, it's all dark.
She could feel the plane sinking under her, and her ears popped repeatedly. Then a sparkle of light appeared somewhere in the gloom. A tiny, bright line, then another line.
Lights!
As they drew closer, she could see that the lights outlined an ordinary runway, and other lights showed in buildings nearby. It looked so normal. Instead of rolling up to one of the lighted buildings, the plane swung aside near the end of the landing strip. The Nems were on their feet as soon as it landed. Margu, lacking orders, stayed where she was. She and the professor had earbuds set to the same communications channel. Another plane, then another, came to a stop near them. In the dark, with only faint light from the runway lights, Margu could just make out dark figures leaving one of the other planes. Then someone forward opened the hatch of their plane, and a cold breath of sea air swirled into the plane past the dark forms. The troops began to move out into the night.
Professor, you and the ensign, come on, now.
The professor heaved himself up, and Margu scrambled out of her seat to follow him. Outside, it was colder, but slightly less dark. Margu could tell the professor from the others as a slightly lighter blur. She pulled up the hood of her PPU against the chill and stayed close to his side. A delicate red line pointed the way. Someone had their laser guide on. She could feel the rasp of the runway surface under her boots.
Is it safe?
No one had fired a shot yet, and the troops seemed to know where they were going. Margu wasn't sure where the first troops had gone. She couldn't see them anymore.
Looks secure for now, Professor. Come on inside.
Margu felt, more than saw, the troops closing in around them, a protective cordon, guiding them to one of the buildings near the landing strip. Ahead, a door opened, spilling out yellow light. She blinked, tried not to stare at the welcome light, but watched for any threat. She couldn't see anything but the troops who had come with them, and the dark night beyond. Inside, Major Garson was talking to a lieutenant commander. Both of them looked tense and unhappy. Armed guards stood at each exit. Margu looked past them to the civilians, the other scientists, she supposed, in the large room.
Oh, Lord, it is Gussie, complete with that ugly yellow jacket and a cute redhead in tow.
She's not a cute redhead in tow. She's Ensign Pardolt. Show some respect. She's a very intelligent young woman.
The other man flashed a smile at Margu.
Meaning he talked your ear off and you didn't object. I'm Helmut Swearingen, by the way.
He turned back to the professor.
When you didn't show up this morning, Gussie, and then those people took the station, we were afraid you'd been captured.
How far have you gotten?
The other man grimaced and nodded toward the officers near the door.
Nowhere. As soon as we heard, and Ty was on the radio trying to find out where you were, so we heard right away. I went to our base commander and told him we should start dismantling the work in progress, destroying notes. He wouldn't have it. Insisted he had to wait for orders, that we were under fleet discipline. Even said we might be mutineers ourselves. He's had us under guard in this room.
What's he like?
A worrier. The only good thing about him is that he's technically trained, so at least he's understood some of what we're doing. He's actually got an advanced degree, studied with Bruno at the Gradus Institute, but he's got a serious addiction to regulations. And he claims regulations won't let him make any independent decisions about what we have here.
We don't have any time to waste. What's his name?
Alcandor Vinant.
The two officers were glowering at each other now. Margu looked from one to the other.
Excuse me, Commander Vinant. I'm Professor Adison. You were expecting me this morning.
You're late, Professor. But I suppose under the circumstances, this is understandable.
Yes. Now that I'm here, I'm taking charge of the research unit. We'll need to start clearing away files before the mutineers can capture...
You can't do that. It's out of the question. I've had no orders from headquarters.
Under the circumstances, sir...
He's got the highest level clearance and authorization. And I've got orders cut at Dark Harbor, directing you to give your complete cooperation.
Dark Harbor's not in my chain of command. And you don't have the rank, Major. Now, how do I know you're not all mutineers anyway?
The professor's eyebrows rose steeply.
All of us? Nah, that's an interesting hypothesis, but do you have any data to support it? Why would mutineers want to deny other mutineers highly effective weaponry? Do you know, I'm more inclined to suspect someone who tries to preserve it intact for capture.
Are you accusing me of being a mutineer?
Not at all. I'm merely pointing out that your refusal to carry through on the very reasonable suggestion of my colleagues, all the orders I'm giving you, could be misunderstood in case of later investigation.
That's ridiculous. This installation is extremely valuable. The equipment alone is
worthless to the Familius if it gets into the wrong hands. Worse than worthless. Don't you understand that?
Well, of course. But there's no proof the mutineers are after it. They may not even know about it.
You're assuming they're stupid. That's not a good position to take, Commander. I'm afraid I must insist on your cooperation.
Margue noticed Garson's signal to his troops. So, she saw, did Vinet. He sagged a little.
Very well. But it's over my protest, and I will log this. If you had not barged in here with overwhelming force, you'd find yourself in the brig for such nonsense.
Thank you. I appreciate your position and your assistance.
The professor led Margue back to the cluster of civilians.
Gussie, we had an idea. Maybe we could mount the big guy and then attack the mutineers.
Mounted on a planet? That's interesting. That might actually work if we have time. Do we have the supplies for adequate shielding?
Yes, if we dismantle a couple of other things. Oh, and Ty was working on breaking into their communications before Vinet snatched him out of the communications shack and stuck him in here with us.
The professor glanced at Margue.
Ensign, you're going to be hearing many things you should not hear, and which I advise you to forget as quickly as possible. Do you have any specialty background in technical fields?
Aside from growing up making what we needed from scrap, no. Basic electronics and carpentry.
Well, that may be useful. Come along. We're going to the labs.
They began with a short meeting in what looked like a snack lounge, with a row of programmable food processors on one wall and battered chairs and couches around the others. A half-finished child's model of a space station cluttered the low table. Margue had not suspected scientists of playing with such toys, and someone quickly moved it to a far corner.
What have we got for communications, Ty?
A skinny man with a bush of black hair came forward.
They've got the sats, but we can reach mainland with something I cobble together. Getting into the mutineers' lines is going to be harder. They've got tight link capability up there. But they've transmitted some outside, and that I can grab if I have access to the equipment. I can tight link if you give me an hour or so, but we don't have anyone to send to.
What about scan? Can we detect anything beyond atmosphere?
Well, only for whatever's in our horizon. The problem's going to be tracking, not to mention what's below horizon. We can point something up, but we don't have an accurate fix if we do find a ship.
Do you need anyone else to help you?
No, not really. There's a pretty decent enlisted tech I could use, but I'm a little worried that the mutineers had one or more agents on this base, and he'd be the logical one.
Fine. Ensign, get Ty and escort from our group to the communication shack, would you?
Margue was supposed to guard his back, but this required only going to the door. Lieutenant Lightfoot was outside waiting. He called over two NEMs who went off with Ty.
Now, Cole, you said you had an idea.
Yeah. Jin and I think it might be possible to rig the big guy for planet-to-space work. We've been trying to come up with the best way to acquire and track the target.
Which target?
Well, we're pretty sure we can take out the orbital station and any ships docked there. Distant stuff, without the use of satellite-based scans, is going to be harder.
But I think we could do it. If we take out the station, then get the satellites linked to us...
How many hours?
6 or 7 to mount the weapon, and it'll take a lot of personnel.
We may not have 6 or 7 hours. We need to know if they're coming and how soon. Jen, what about scan within atmosphere? Is there any way to get access to the satellite data?
Not right now. What we have here is basically old-style radar for spotting and guiding air traffic, and a little local weather scanner. The range is so short that we couldn't spot incoming LACs in time to do anything useful. We haven't needed more than that. We had the satellite data for long scan. We really need those satellites. And for that, we'll need to break their lock. It's not going to be easy, and it's going to take time.
Which, again, we may not have. Bob, what about Project Zed?
Operational. And we really don't want them to have it.
It actually works?
Oh, yeah. If this were a ship and not an island, I could flip the switch and they'd never find us. A big improvement over the earlier models. Unfortunately, since it is an island, it's easily located no matter what cloud we wrap around ourselves.
Margie realized with a start that they were talking about new stealth gear.
Could it be used to cover a retreat in the aircraft if we took the data and ran for the mainland?
I suppose. No, we haven't tried it on an aircraft. How much can those planes lift?
I'll ask.
The professor glanced at Margue, who headed for the door again. She passed the question off to Lightfoot and went back to the professor. In that brief interval, the discussion had already turned too technical for her understanding.
Come in. Ty, what do you know?
I found two things. One's a data log showing transmissions to this station from Stack 3 5 days ago. From Bakarian. I think someone here's on their payroll.
Most likely. And?
And a transmission from orbit to this station, just now. Personal, for Lieutenant Commander Vinette.
For Vinette? Did you answer it?
No, just acknowledged receipt, using the same SIG code that was logged for reply to the others. But I did take a look.
Wasn't it encrypted?
Yeah, but a simple one, not hard to break. But here's the thing. He's not only part of it. They were telling him they'd be coming down in a day or so, and not to worry, that they prevent anyone from sending word from the station, so here we are, and nobody else knows what's going on.
We have to get the word out somehow.
You're quite right, Ensign. And we have to keep them upstairs from finding out that we're here, if possible, to give ourselves time to work, to destroy what we can't protect.
We'll need the troops that came with you, Gussie, to keep the baddies out of our hair.
Right. Ty, did your guard come back with you?
No, I left him there to guard the equipment.
Ensign, we'll need Major Garson.
Margue told Lightfoot, who hurried off, and in a minute or two, Garson appeared. He listened to Ty's report, scowling.
I'll put Vinette under arrest then. I wonder how many baddies were with him.
And I wonder how many are with you, sir.
None, I hope. Can you people take care of the rest of it?
Building a tight beam with the power to a ship in system, yes. Building a scan to locate such a ship, yes. Destroy the more delicate research and the records, yes. But it will take time, Major. There are only 14 of us, and some of the work is specialized enough that only one person can do it. So, we'd best get at it.
The professor nodded to Garson, and the Major withdrew.
One thing worries me.
Only one?
If they don't know we're here, they won't be in as big a hurry to get down here. But when the cloud cover goes, they'll be bound to take a look. And they'll see our transport sitting there like a big sign saying, "Hi, we're here."
We could send them back, but then we'd be stuck here. Besides, the latent heat would still show on a fine-grain IR scan.
If you just want to hide the planes from scan, we can do that with Zed. Set it for just those parameters. It'd be a good test.
And if it fails, they'd not only know we were here, but they'd also know about Zed.
It's a lot quicker to dismantle and destroy than the big guy.
How many more hours of darkness? And does anyone have a clue about the weather?
A local sunrise is at 8:13 tomorrow. It'll be light before that, of course, if it's clear.
And we have no weather sats. But we can always go outside and look.
When they opened the door, a squad waited to accompany them. The professor told Ty to get back to the communications shack. Half the squad went with him. With the others, he went outside to look at the weather. Outside, a cold, wet wind scoured the ground. Margue stayed close to the professor, looking up only once to see that no stars showed.
I can't tell. Bob, go on and rig Zed to cover the planes. We'll start dismantling the other stuff.
Professor, we can't find Vinette or several others. I want you all back inside until we find him.
That could take days. Some of the labs are underground, connected by tunnels.
Ty's at the communications shack. He has guards.
Down the runway, one of the planes was blazing, the flames shooting up to glow on the underside of the clouds.
Great. They can spot that right through the cloud cover. Get inside now!
Where's Lieutenant Lightfoot?
I don't know. He's not answering the comm.
Another brighter flare of light painted one side of the Major's face. the second plane.
Ensign, switch your PPU mask to enhanced and get those civilians back under cover. That yellow jacket makes a perfect target.
Margu fumbled for the mask controls, and instead of dark clouds and the distant fire, she was looking at a scene painted in shades of amber and orange. She could see little orange figures moving around, some with green triangles for heads. The blazing fire looked black. As her eyes adjusted, she noticed that the professor had a green triangle, and so did the NEMs around them. Then, a turquoise line stabbed across her vision to crawl up the professor's sleeve toward his head. Margu threw herself at him, hooked a leg behind his, and they fell together as a shot smacked into the armor of the NEM on the other side. He staggered, then all of the NEMs dropped as one.
Target acquired! Mark hostile!
Margu turned her head and saw that one orange figure now had a red square on top. The distant figure went down. She lifted her head, and the NEM shoved it back down.
Not yet, Ensign. May not be dead and may be others.
Casualties?
No, sir. Small arms fire only. Didn't penetrate armor. Civilians all unharmed.
Who's on high guard?
Tarak and Bennett's report.
No activity on the roof, sir.
Let's get them inside.
The NEMs formed a double row of armor, and the civilians crawled carefully between them into the building. But no more shots were fired. Margu took a last look through her enhanced mask, and the orange figure still lay where it had fallen. Then a network of turquoise lines appeared, coming from several angles to converge on the antenna cover of the communications building. She leaned out to see, and a NEM yanked her back.
Are you trying to get killed?
No, I just...
Get inside! Stay inside! Take care of your professor!
Margu followed the others into the windowless break room. The professor was looking at her in a way that made her uncomfortable.
What are they doing?
I think they're trying to destroy the antenna array. It's under that dome in the communications building, isn't it?
Yes, and if they succeed, we're not going to be able to use a tight beam, even if we construct one.
Why a tight beam?
Goes farther, carries more data. We might even be able to reach the system Ansible if we can get a fix on it. That would get word out.
But wouldn't a regular broadcast disperse more widely, giving you more chance to warn any incoming ships that wasn't part of the mutiny?
You mean, like old-fashioned broadcasting?
Yes, if you have enough power.
And the antenna is much easier to make. You may have saved more than just my life, Ensign.
The RSS Vigor came through the jump point in textbook fashion. Just because they knew they were coming into a secure system, just because nothing could possibly be wrong, was no reason to be careless. Captain Satir would not have paid attention if anyone had complained, and no one did. Satir was a good captain, and his fussy adherence to every little jot and tittle of the rules had saved lives before. Now, Vigor slowed to scan the system defenses and monitor system message traffic before proceeding in system, even as her beacon automatically informed the system who she was. As she dumped velocity, the communications officer stripped one message after another, hardly glancing at them as they came off the printer. Captain Satir demanded hard copy, even if that did mean plenty of recycling. He handed them to the captain's runner, who took them to Satir. Satir was already alert, peering at the system scan.
I've been to Copper Mountain 8 times, and the outer loop's never been all red.
I've been here 10 times and never seen this many big ships in system. What's going on?
We're 10 minutes out. 20 delay on queries.
I don't think I want to talk to the station. Put us at battle stations, Tony, but don't light up the weapons.
Colored lights danced across the various control boards reporting systems in operation. Satir glanced at the sheets of paper in his lap. Trouble. Major trouble.
Sir, there's an odd signal coming in. You need to see it now.
Odd how?
Not the usual frequencies, for one thing. It's surface propagated, but not a coherent signal. It's like they didn't care who picked it up. It'd dissipate the noise within this system, though.
And it says?
It's in clear, and it says there's a mutiny at Copper Mountain. That the mutineers have the orbital station in control of system defenses. It's begging somebody to get the word out.
Captain Satir looked at his bridge officers. If this was a hoax, reacting as if it were real could end his career. If it was not a hoax, he had only one chance to get away. Even as he hesitated, a bank of lights on the scan desks came alight.
They're aiming at us, tracking us.
Full ahead. Find us a slot and take us to jump. We're getting out of here while we can.
Vigor had the speed and the angle. None of the ships in system could catch them in straight flight, and he was prepared to jump blind if necessary to put more distance between them.
Make extra copies of all scan data and try a squirt at the system Ansible as we go by. They may have reprogrammed it, but it's worth a try.
4 days later, Vigor came in range of an Ansible in another system and transmitted an emergency override command set, followed by the entire load of scan data she'd collected. Oh. The long room, with its high ceiling, would have held 20 pairs of fencers, and had before. The walls were pale green above the mirrors, and the gilt, beaded molding around the ceiling was echoed by the molding around the mirrors. The east wall, a bank of French windows, let in the natural daylight and overlooked a rose garden. Down the middle of the polished parquet floor ran the strip, deep green. Miranda finished her stretches and picked up her practice foil. Facing the mirrors, she could see that Pater, though still stretching, was watching her. She moved through the parries, smoothly but not fast, feeling for the rhythm that would best suit her needs. He finished his stretches, but made no move to pick up his own blade. He stood watching her instead. She met his eyes in the mirror, then turned.
What? Am I doing something wrong?
No, my dear. I was thinking how lovely you are, and how incongruous it is always to see a beautiful woman holding a deadly weapon.
Miranda touched the button, bending the blade with only a little pressure.
This? Even if it weren't so whippy, it could hardly kill anyone.
Oh, it's the principle of the thing, and I've seen you with stiffer blades.
I was younger then.
You were ladies' champion in épée. I have never forgotten your grace that day.
I was lucky. Berenice ran out of breath. I've always suspected she had a cold. Usually she beat me.
But still, if you had live steel in hand in the old days, I don't doubt you'd have been a formidable opponent.
I'll take that as a compliment. Shall we?
I was going to ask for a favor.
A favor? What?
I see you have Bunny's old collection here, in the hall. I know he never let anyone actually use it, but do you suppose we could?
Bait and hook, taken faster than she'd expected.
The old weapons. But, Pater, they're old. I don't even know how old, some of them.
If I could just hold them, just, you know, feel them.
I don't even know if they're really mine to lend. I mean, they're here because Bunny brought them along, but they are his family's heirlooms. You're the one who said I should be fair to Harless.
Harless need never know. It's just, the oldest steel I've ever held was that antique Gregory has, you know.
Oh, that old thing. It's not a day over 200, whatever he says. These are much older.
I know, that's why I asked. Please.
Pater cocked his head and put his hands together like a polite child.
I suppose it couldn't hurt, if we're careful.
Miranda could feel her heart speed up, safely hidden under her white jacket, as she led the way back to the hall. She unlocked the case and stood back. Pater reached past her and took out, as she'd expected, the big saber with a heavy ornamented hilt. He ran his thumb down the blade.
Bunny said they were still usable, but he didn't want to take a chance on breakage. They're not replaceable.
Pater breathed on the blade, then buffed it with his sleeve.
No. Derrigay work. Look at that pattern. And the ring.
Pater set the blade back and took down another.
You have no idea their age.
Bunny always said that one, the épée, was the oldest, and the rapier the next oldest. He said it was just possible those two were from old Earth, from an era when they might have been used.
Pater put the rapier back and took the broad, curved blade for which she had no name.
Amazing. And this?
I don't know. It looks more like a chopper to me, for very large potatoes.
Not a blade for artistry, no. An executioner's weapon, perhaps, from a very bloody period.
His hand reached again, this time for a foil.
So, this is your weight now?
His hand stroked the blade, bent it.
Not so whippy as the one you were using, but light enough, I'll warrant.
She had to be fair. She had to be scrupulously fair, and let his own folly put him in danger.
Oh, probably. I still practice with heavier blades now and then.
Let's fence with these, not the modern ones.
I don't think it's a good idea. I don't know what they would think.
They? What they? Who could possibly dispute with you now that the judgment has gone your way? What harm could it cause?
I don't know. What if a blade breaks? What if Harless appeals and then finds out I've destroyed a valuable asset?
He needn't know. He isn't a fencer. He's probably never paid attention to them. Besides, I'll explain it was all my idea.
Pater nodded at the helms.
Look, let's do it right. Use all the old gear, masks as well. It would be like fancy dress.
He had always liked fancy dress. He had worn it to balls where other men wore conventional clothes.
But
just this once, there's no one to see. Please.
Again, that tip of the head, the pleading expression. Then an impish grin.
I'll bet you've always wanted to, haven't you?
As a matter of fact, I did sneak that one out once. There's something about it. Knowing it's old, knowing it was used by people long dead.
Yes, I thought so. Just as you enjoy old porcelain or jewelry. Those who appreciate such things should not be forbidden the use of them. So you will humor me this once, Miranda?
Miranda glanced around as if nervous of watchers.
I suppose. And after all, if we do break one and Harless finds out, as you said, he's no fencer. He can hardly skewer me.
Well, my lady, choose your weapon.
Pater set the blade he'd been holding back in the rack and waved her forward with an extravagant gesture. Miranda reached, pulled back as if unsure, and finally took the blade he had just replaced, the longest of the foils, with a weighted hilt to balance it. He took its partner.
Let's complete the mischief. As I said, with such blades as these, our helms too should match. I've long fancied myself in one of these. Had my armorer make a replica, but it's not the same.
He tried on one, then another, until he found one that fit. Miranda raised her brows at him.
It can't be safe, Pater. Blades last, but old metal screening...
It will stand up to a blunted stroke. And if I cannot defend my face, at least I'm not much of a fighter. Come, my dear. If you're nervous, you must wear your usual mask, but permit me my conceit. The only way you will strike my eye is with your beauty.
That comment was all that Miranda needed to erode the last grain of sympathy she felt. She could have shot him where he stood, but she was not going to trial for the murder of a murderer. Back in the salle, after they had clipped the buttons to the tip of the blades, Pater moved out of the shadow to stand in one of the bars of sun, a glowing white figure with a shining golden bronze head. The old helm gleamed in the light. She could not see his face through the pierced metal. From within her own mask, the world narrowed to the strip itself and the opponent across from her.
Can he see my face?
She let herself smile now, with no guarding tension. She brought her blade up in salute, as did he. Then he advanced. Miranda presented a quite ordinary opening, and Pater accepted. In a friendly bout such as this, there was no hurry, so they crossed blades in easy parry-riposte combinations for some 15 exchanges.
You're so graceful.
You're so quick.
For you, I would gladly slow.
His next stroke was slightly slower, and she met it just an instant late. If she could convince him to slow, if she could set a pace that lulled him into the wrong rhythm.
I used to be faster. I know I did.
It's that blade, my dear. It's too heavy for you.
I need something.
She blocked his stroke, threw one intentionally slow, which he blocked easily.
No, against you. I need the extra length and the stiffness.
Bah! I'm not going to press you harder than you can handle. You should know that, Miranda. When was I ever importunate?
You weren't. It's just...
Pater stepped back and grounded his blade.
Come, let's exchange blades. That was made for a man. You can tell by the weight of the hilt.
Besides, you want to try it.
True. Indulge me, my dear.
Very well. But I'm going to do more conditioning. I swear I am. I didn't realize how out of shape I was. All those days of the funeral and arrangements.
Of course.
He handed her the foil, hilt first, over his arm with a bow. She handed him her weapon with equal grace, and they exchanged places on the strip, as always after an exchange of weapons. Miranda was sure she knew which of the old weapons had actually drawn blood. She knew nothing would show on analysis. She knew her belief was irrational and indefensible, but the foil conveyed to her an eagerness for blood that matched her own. It had from the moment she first handled the old weapons.
Lady Cecilia DeMarto's called. She's docked and taken one of the personal shuttles.
Cecilia coming. I'm so close.
With an effort, Miranda regained her concentration. She would figure out something, as long as it was over before Cecilia walked in. She found it hard at first to conceal the speed the foil lent her. Her heart hammered, more excitement than effort. She dared not use her own pulse for a timer. She dared not wait too long, either. She backed a pace, then another. Then, with a quick disengage, lunged, and made the touch. With contact, she twisted her wrist and pushed, taking Pater's tip on her left shoulder. Through her hand, she felt the faintest give to the tip.
We're both dead.
The mask across from her gave no hint of Pater's expression. He stepped back, as she did, to salute and begin again.
Is the tip gone?
The foil felt no different. He parried his next stroke and his next. The tip gave way, flipped by her blade's elastic recoil into a parabolic arc. She had to drag her eyes away from it to check the break. Pater froze an instant, then started to withdraw.
I'm afraid a blade broke.
Miranda saw the tilt of his helm as he looked to check his own, saw it move back. She waited until she knew he had time to see her blade, the sharp tip exposed by the spiral fracture.
Miranda?
The tip of her blade slammed into her target, a particular perforation in the metal of his mask. Her blade snapped on the back of his skull, and quickly as she withdrew it, he was already falling. Miranda sank with him, still watchful, until his hand loosened. Then she dropped her own sword, grabbed at his shoulders.
No! Pater, no!
Cecilia heard the cry as she came through the door and saw Miranda, recognizable by both form and the golden hair that spilled out the back of her helm, facing away from her, clutching at the shoulders of her opponent, who was collapsing. She moved forward quickly.
Is that Pater?
Miranda was scrabbling at the other person's mask, trying to get it off.
Miranda, let me help. Call medical.
It won't come off. It won't come off.
Miranda's gloved fingers clumsily yanked at some kind of latch. Now Cecilia could see the blood trickling out where the mask had given way, and the blood on the broken short length of blade.
I told him it was dangerous. Bunny always said no one should use the old blades or trust the old armor, but he wanted to. He insisted.
Cecilia discovered that her mind was already working again when she recognized all this as elements of alibi. She worked at the other side of the man's helm, wondering why the ancients had made everything so complicated. Surely this hadn't been made before the advent of pressure locks.
What happened? The blade broke. I was lunging, and it just shattered.
Cecilia looked, but could see only the shadowed shape of Miranda's face behind the mask.
I thought you said fencing was safe.
It is. It's... He wanted to use the old blades, the ones Bunny would never use. He knew Harless wouldn't allow it, but then he said, why not the old helms? He was in one of his moods. You know how Pater is.
Cecilia had one side of the helm loose now and began working on the other.
You didn't call for medical help.
Ceci, when a blade goes in the eye, there is no help.
In the eye?
Cecilia had the other side of the helm open and lifted it away. There was Pater's face, one eye open but dulled already with anoxia, and the other a bloody hole.
Miranda!
Cecilia looked at her, trying to see through that mask, but sunlight blazed on the metal, and behind it was only shadow. She looked down at the gloved hands, one streaked with blood, at Miranda's neck, where the high collar of her fencing habit hid her pulse. A crowd of servants rushed in.
Milady, what happened?
We were fencing and the blade broke.
Miranda took her own mask off slowly, her hands trembling. tears had streaked her cheeks. She looked paler than usual, with red-rimmed eyes.
I've never seen you cry before, except for Bunny.
You didn't see me when I heard about Brun's capture, or when the babies were born. Sammons, we'll need a doctor, though I know it's too late, and the militia. This man was Minister of Foreign Affairs. We'll have to have an investigation.
All through the questions that followed, Cecilia sat quietly to one side, watching Miranda, listening to the timbre of her voice. Pater had been coming to Fence twice weekly since arriving on Cerealis. Pater had initiated the practices. He had also come to talk business, and... she hesitated, and a faint color came into her cheeks, to propose a familial alliance. On that day, they had begun as usual, but Pater had asked, as he had before, about the antique weapons in the hall. Where were they going, and who would inherit them? He had wanted to handle them, fence with them. Bunny had never allowed it, but Pater had begged. And she had given in, agreed to fence with the old weapons, though they had not been inspected.
She must have scan data. She would not dare go into such detail if scan would not support what she said.
Slow anger churned in Cecilia's stomach. These had been her friends, or at least people she had known, people of her class. Wealthy, urbane, sophisticated. She had known them all her life. And now they were killing each other off. Lorenza trying to poison her. Chemtree agreeing to poison his own son. Someone, Pater, by his bragging, arranging to kill Bunny. Miranda killing Pater.
Are they all crazy? And if they are, why? And who benefits?
They all depended on pharmaceuticals for rejuve. They had all been rejuved multiple times. Lorenza, Chemtree, Pater, Miranda, even her own sister Berenice. Some had access to other illicit drugs, like the neurotoxins Lorenza had poisoned her with. Once she'd known Lorenza was dead, she'd given no serious thought to the source of that drug. Lorenza was a vicious, sadistic woman. That was the threat, not the drug. It's not the weapon, it's the person who misuses it. But she knew. She knew about Patchcock. Though she'd put it out of her mind when Ronnie and Rafa were safely married. Bad drugs. Bad rejuvenation drugs, and who knows what else. And the fallout might be worse than anyone had thought.
Is Miranda sane? Are any of them sane? Is there anyone I can trust?
Finally, the initial interviews were over, and Cecilia went up with Miranda to her suite. A white-faced maid brought them a tray of food and hot tea. Miranda stripped off her fencing whites and took a shower, while Cecilia stared out the tall windows to the hummocky country of the Blue Hunt. By the time Miranda came back in, wrapped in a thick quilted robe, Cecilia had her own questions in order.
Miranda, remember when I told you what Pater told me shortly after Bunny died?
Of course. You told me that you thought Pater knew who had killed him, that it was not the new Tex militia.
Is that...
Cecilia, Pater has always been a bit of a bore, you know that.
Yes, but...
He thought himself a man of power. He wanted to improve his status within the Consuline Sept. So naturally, he claimed to have knowledge you didn't have.
You didn't take him seriously?
Not at first, no. He came courting, you see.
Courting?
Yes. Hinting that if I had his protection, I need not fear Harless's challenge to the will, that I would get to keep Cerealis. He meant he would get Cerealis.
He honestly thought you would marry him?
Apparently. He asked if he could come here. I put him off several times, but finally consented.
But why?
I wanted to know what he knew, how he was so sure he could do what he claimed. It's not the kind of thing you can ask over a comm line, I thought. Yeah, if he visited, I could assess his abilities and intentions better.
But you weren't going to marry him.
Heavens, Cecilia, you do stick like a burr. No, I was not going to marry him. I'm not going to marry anyone.
I'm going to fight Harless on Button's behalf and save the inheritance, but I'm not going to marry. I had the best for most of my life. Why would I settle for crumbs now?
I don't know. I just worry.
No need. Oh.
Ugh. Miranda stretched, then strolled over to the pool. Fat orange goldfish rose to the surface and swam nearer.
I'm not crazy. I didn't get my rejuve drugs from the Moralines, and I'm not going to rejuve again. Once I get my children settled...
I thought I'd never get rejuved. Wouldn't have if not for the poison. But I rather like it now.
I understand that. You have more things you want to do. But I'm nominal 40 now. Actual... well, you know the actuality. And I have another 60 years of health without rejuve. 60 years without Bunny is plenty.
You might find someone else.
And gold might drop from the sky in showers. If I do, I can rejuve then, if I want. But it's not something to plan on. End of discussion, Ceci. Tell me, have you been down to the stables yet?
No.
Then you should. If something happens and Harless ends up with Cerealis after all, you should know if there's anything here you'd like to put a bid on.
Can't believe he'd be stupid enough to shut down the stables.
A horse broke his foot when he was a boy, and then he cracked some ribs falling off into rocks trying to keep up with Bunny. He thinks horses are large, smelly abominations, a drain on the income, which they are, actually. We've never made money off the horses.
Miranda, you're distracting me with horses, and I'm not that foolish. Did you kill Pater on purpose?
Miranda gave Cecilia a long, silent look.
Do you think I would do something like that?
I don't know any more what people will and won't do. I didn't think Lorenzo would poison me. I didn't think Bunny's brother would terrorize an old lady into giving up her shares. Or that Pater would have Bunny assassinated to get a ministry.
We are not answering each other's questions. And I think that's probably wise. But I will remind you of that old, old rule.
Which one?
A lady is never rude by accident.
Miranda put a dollop of honey in her tea.
Oh, I needed that.
Sticking a blade into someone's brain and stirring goes beyond mere rudeness.
That's true. But the rule also applies in other situations as well. Cecilia, if you're going to make a fuss, please do so.
You're not even asking me not to.
No. Your decisions are yours, as mine are mine.
What are you going to tell your children?
That Pater died in a fencing accident. They have brains, Cecilia, and imagination. They will put on it what construction they please.
Cecilia ate another jam-filled tart and stared out the window again.
I suppose it sends a message to Hobart.
I hope so.
Esme scowled at the message strip the clerk handed her.
I thought we had it all arranged. Why meet in a private room and not in the restaurant?
She scanned the lift tubes, looking for the right range. 37 to 40. Odd. Most tubes served at least 10 floors. She tapped the access button.
Room and name, please.
What?
If Baron had been there, she'd have whacked him in the head, but he wasn't.
3814, Lieutenant Sweeza.
The lift tube access slid open, with the supporting grid glowing green for up. Esme stepped in and found herself in a mirrored cylinder that rose smoothly, with none of the exuberance of most lift tubes. Her ears popped once, then again.
It's only 38 floors. What's happening here?
She stepped out into a green carpeted foyer, the walls striped in subtle shades of beige and cream.
Wow.
The pictures on the wall. She caught her breath at the bold geometric. Surely that was a reproduction. She stepped closer. No. The thick wedge of purple that cast a shadow in every reproduction cast a different shadow here, lit as it was by a pin spot on the opposite wall. Genuine Oscar Crammon. She shook her head and looked around. Beyond the foyer, a short hall had but four doors opening off it, and one was labeled service. Baron must have spent a fortune. 3814 was the middle door. She moved into its recognition cone and waited.
The door opened, and she was face to face with a middle-aged woman she'd never seen. Before she could begin to stammer an apology, the woman smiled.
Lieutenant Sweeza, how good to meet you. I'm Pajar Serrano, Baron's mother.
Baron's mother?
Esme had been prepared for Baron, for a few stolen moments of privacy, a chance to talk before she met his mother.
Come in. We're all dying to meet you.
We all?
She could hear a low hum of voices and wanted nothing more than to run away. Podjar had her by the arm, Baron's mother. She couldn't just pull away. And led her inside to a room that seemed as big as a planet right then.
Here she is at last.
Podjar smiled at someone else, a short, thickset man who had Baron's grin but nothing of his grace.
This is Karen, my husband.
Farther into the room, Esme's stunned wits began to register additional details. Not only was the room big and arranged for entertaining, but it was comfortably full of people who all seemed to know each other.
Esme!
Her heart leapt. That was Baron, and he would get her out of this, whatever it was. He came toward her, clearly gleeful and full of himself. She could have killed him and hoped he understood steel behind her fixed smile.
I'm sorry I wasn't at the lift to meet you. I had an urgent call.
What is this?
It got out of hand. I wanted you to meet my parents, and they were coming through here on the way home. Then grandmother...
Baron waved. Esme followed the gesture to see Admiral Vita Serrano at the far end of the room, surrounded by an earnest cluster of older people.
Grandmother wanted to talk to you about something, and thought this would be a good opportunity. And then they started precipitating, falling out of the sky.
Are we going to have a chance to talk?
I don't know. I hope so, but...
Baron's gaze slid to his mother, who quirked an eyebrow.
Baron? You know it's important family business. We must confer.
Great.
The only leave she'd been able to wangle in the current crises, and it looked as if she'd be spending it conferring with his family instead of hers. Baron's father had Lieutenant Commander's insignia with a technical flash.
How was your trip, Esme?
Fine, though we lost a day at Carpad for unscheduled maintenance procedures.
Well, that's typical. Let me show you to your room.
My...
Of course you have your own room here. We may have descended in force, but we're not entirely uncivilized. You have to stay somewhere.
Across the room, through another door, into another corridor, Esme was by this time beyond astonishment when he showed her to a small suite, its sitting room wall showing a view of the station's exterior.
This is yours. And I'm sure the staff are sending up your things.
I only have the carry-on.
Huh. Well then, come out when you're ready.
With a smile, he turned away and closed the door behind him. Esme sank down onto one of the rose and cream-striped chairs. What she wanted to do was put her head into her hands and scream. That wouldn't be productive, she was sure.
But what's going on? Come in!
The door opened, and Baron stood there looking sheepish.
May I?
Esme nodded. He entered, shutting the door behind him, and pulled her up from the chair. She stiffened for a moment, then relaxed against him.
Oh, your family.
I'm sorry. Wasn't my idea, but it is my family. They're headstrong.
And you aren't?
Esme wasn't ready to think it was funny. She wanted to indulge her annoyance, such justified annoyance, a little longer. But suddenly her sense of humor kicked in. She could just imagine Baron having planned this quiet little retreat, being maneuvered by his powerful and numerous family.
Not headstrong enough. I tried to tell him to let us alone, but you could see how well I did. You aren't angry?
Not at you, anyway. I suppose a quiet few days alone was too much to hope for.
Well, I didn't think so. You would think the entire universe was playing tricks on us.
I've read that lovers always put themselves in the center of everything.
I'd like to put us in the center of a bed. Long way from everywhere else.
Oh, we'll get there.
Esme's arms tightened around him. He felt as good as ever, and she wanted to melt right into him until their bones chimed together.
Baron, if you don't let her get dressed, we'll never get to dinner.
Oh, shut up. Why wasn't I born an orphan?
It would have been too simple. Let me go. I want to change. And are we eating up here or in public? Not that the entire Serrano family isn't public enough, mind you.
Here, it's coming up.
Baron let go, went to the door, and opened it. There stood a woman in her 30s, about Esme's size, with the Serrano features.
Esme, I'm Dulcent. Baron, go away. I need to talk to her for a moment.
I hate you.
But he left. Dulcent grinned.
Listen, I gather you were expecting a quiet evening of entertainment, and you have only one carry-on. If I were in that situation, I'd have brought only the clothes I meant to wear, which weren't exactly family meeting ones. So, may I offer you something?
Annoyance returned, a wave of it. But then she remembered the contents of her carry-on. Clothes for a casual day or so with her fiancé, one nice dress to meet the parents. The woman was right. Esme swallowed another lump of resentment.
Thank you.
I wouldn't like having to borrow clothes, but there are times. Have a look.
Esme had to admit that Dulcent's offerings were better than anything she'd brought, and Dulcent's blue tunic over her own casual slacks met both requirements.
Thanks.
Never mind. I'll raid your wardrobe someday. If you make my little brother happy, that is.
Otherwise, you'll blow it up?
Something like that. Or if you call me Dolly. Just a warning.